Chris Preston.
And I'm Brad Zimmerman.
And welcome to Street Check, the best podcast in the history of Cabot Wealth Network. Brad, before we get into it, you're off to Vegas this weekend. Should we expect you back for next week's podcast?
Yeah. I'm not, I'm no longer at the sort of like late 20s, early 30s, where it's an existential crisis if you go to Vegas, because you might end up at a club or you might end up in a hotel you don't recognize. It's going to be arts, experiences, high-end dining, and nice hotels. So I'm very much in the old man Vegas category right now.
No kids, though?
No. The kids are staying with my in-laws, so it'll be a nice little vacation for my wife and I. Haven't had a ton of those in the last decade, but that's what small kids will do for you. Do you guys get out much? Just you and your wife at all? Or is it always
not to Vegas? I've literally never been to Vegas, but yeah, I mean, dinner and stuff, not off to Vegas for
it's like an hour flight, so it's not really a big deal. We're right there. But
our Vegas is Montreal. I mean, it's not like Vegas, but Montreal is an hour and a half drive.
Atlantic City would be like your Vegas.
That's further away. Montreal, people go. We're 45 minutes from the border where we are in Vermont, so we go up, we drive up for weekends or even nights, pretty easy with friends occasionally. We went there for my wife's birthday in November, so that was good.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, but enough about our weekends of luxury. Let's get into this week's stock market. Lots going on. Brad, why don't you fill people in what we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, so this week we are going to talk about inflation, what that means for the macro conditions. We're going to talk a little bit about earnings. Big banks came out, reported this morning, and we'll give a preview for what else is to come this earnings season. Amazon is flipping their money switch at the end of this month, and I will tell you all about that. And then we are going to do our head-to-head sort of matchup jump ball segment, and we're going to break down a couple of competing trends or narratives and look at stocks and some more exciting things in there.
Back by popular demand, and by popular demand, yours and mine.
Yeah. Emails flooding in for that one. Right. Before we get into all of that, though, Chris, this week you are up for Defend the Take. Your take, the Magnificent Seven disappear by year end. You have 90 seconds. You may begin.
Okay. Your wording on that was a little off. The Magnificent Seven themselves will not disappear. That term will all but disappear by the end of the year. You know, I don't think that those stocks, Amazon, Apple, Google, Tesla, Nvidia, Microsoft, Meta, I think I got them. I don't think those stocks are going to flop or anything. I don't think they're going to drive the market the way they did last year. You know, as we've talked about, I think they're going to sort of be in a bit more of a holding pattern. And so the other 493 stocks in the S&P and small cap stocks and others will sort of play catch up. Magnificent Seven was not a term before last year, really. Fangs was the term. What happened to that term? We don't hear that term anymore. It's more about language evolving. You know, it can be trendy, although Fangs has been around for a while. But first it was F-A-N-G, then it was F-A-A-N-G to allow for both Amazon and Apple. And then now it's Magnificent Seven. So either one of these Magnificent Seven will fall off so much that they'll, you know, lose sort of the distinction of being part of that group. Or it'll expand, you know, maybe it'll be other stocks that join the fray. But bottom line is Magnificent Seven will not be the focal point this year where it's driving the market totally for the first 10 months of the year like it did last year. So I think that term will fade away by year's end, and it'll be sort of specific to 2023 thing.
Hey, all right. You hit the post. Yeah. You know, it's funny you bring that up. Early last year, before the Magnificent Seven narrative took hold, MAMA stocks, M-A-A-M-A, it was Meta, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, and Alphabet. That Tesla got added to that, and then I guess you couldn't.
Matama? That's a tough one. Yeah, Mammoth. Yeah, it doesn't quite work.
Have to add Hertz in there or something?
No. Yeah.
Yeah, so with the narrative thing, yeah, it is kind of funny, though, that the Magnificent Seven are just a rebranded Fangs.
Yeah.
Or largely are so.
Yeah. And they let Tesla and Microsoft into the group. And frankly, both of those always sort of deserved. I guess Nvidia is the other one. Yeah, but and I guess Netflix is out in the cold now. they got kicked out.
But, yeah, and it's only going to get worse for them, but we will get there. Before we do, though, let's move on to a little bit of macro talk. Inflation, CPI came in at 0.3% month over month versus 0.2% expected. Market didn't really have much of a reaction to it. Jamie Dimon came out this morning in the JP Morgan call saying that inflation was going to be stickier than people expected.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on what we've got for a path forward with inflation?
You know, I think it says a lot about the current market that there wasn't a big pullback after, you know, these decimal points did matter this time a year ago. They mattered a lot. Even midway through last year, if inflation came in, if the print came in, so it was 3.4%, which was up from 3.1% this year over year. 3.1% in November and 3.3% expected. If it was 0.1% higher than expected last year, that would be a 2% pullback in the market. And this year, you know, in this market, it's, you know, people didn't really bat an eye at it. It didn't really affect things. In fact, the Fed Watch tool, which, you know, shows the expectations for rate cuts, now it's rate cuts, of being 77% now in March, up from, I think you said it was in the 60s%, as recently as a week ago. I looked this morning, it was 71.8%, but it's up to 77 now. So it's going, I would have thought that inflation being slightly higher would have made the chances of a rate cut go down, according to experts, economists, but it's gone up. And you think that has something to do with earnings, which we'll get to in a second. But my point is, we've said for a while that, you know, Fed, or for most of last year, Fed was sort of the, you know, the grim reaper of the market. But now it's flipped where the Fed has become maybe the biggest catalyst behind this bull market. And, you know, even just decimal points higher in inflation are not swaying people off of that stance.
Yeah, so just for some specific numbers, a week ago, the market had a 64% chance that rates would be in the 5 to 5.25 range at the March meeting, which would be a 25 basis point cut. And rather than tease it or save it like it's some gem, I think part of the reason, with their earnings release this week, JP Morgan came out and said that they are expecting a grand total of 6 rate cuts this year, dropping it the Fed rate down to 4%. So from the 5.25 to 5.5, down to like 3.75 to 4 or 4 to 4.25. I mean, 3.75 to 4 would align with their 6.25 point rate cut. So that would be a rate cut every meeting. It'd be all but one meeting. So they probably...
Not the January one, not this month's one.
Well, even with the March, so you've got meetings March, May, June, July, September, November, December. So probably based on JP Morgan's projections, probably one of those summer meetings gets cut or doesn't get cut. That's that right. Just adds confusion.
They cut the cut.
They bypass one of those meetings would I guess be their expectation, or maybe they front load the cuts and then they skip some at the end of the year. That surprised me. I was not expecting anybody to feasibly calling for 6 cuts, even 3 or 4. I mean, 4 seemed a little bit aggressive. 3 seems sort of in line with what the Fed's telegraphing. But, you know, we talked about whether the election year thing matters, whether the Fed might be talking a tougher game than they're actually playing. I think, you know, that certainly aligns with what they were doing at the end of last year. But I think that's probably a big reason why the expectations for a cut by March jumped by almost 6% from this morning and 10% from a week ago.
Right. Okay, let's get on to number two in our big three. That's earnings. Earnings season is officially underway as of today. The banks, some of the big banks reported, including JP Morgan, have reported record annual profits. Citigroup, not quite as strong, $1.8 billion loss. Earnings for this season collectively are expected to be up one among S&P 500 companies, up 1.3%, according to FactSet. As my dog joins the podcast, so 1.3% in Q4, and I think it'll be better than that because so last quarter Q3 it was supposed to be down again minus 0.2% by the same people who predicting this this quarter, and it was up 4.9%. So I think the economy keeps showing, retail in particular, keeps showing that it's stronger than people anticipate. You know, while I don't know if we'll replicate 4.9% growth, I think 1.3% is probably, you know, conservative, and I could see this being, you know, another better than expected quarter for earnings.
Yeah, we've been, you know, we've been leaning on the consumer a lot. And in the lead up to us talking about this, I wanted to see if we could maybe find some earnings announcements that are upcoming that would be a little bit of a temperature check on the consumer. Going back to JP Morgan really briefly in their reporting, they anticipate that their net charge-off rate for credit cards, so right as like a measure of strength of consumer, is going to stay below 3.5% for the year. Their net charge-off in their most recently reported quarter was 2.92%. That, with the expectation that it's going to stay sort of muted like that, that would tell me that we are sort of at a point of max pain for consumers, yep, where everything that we're sort of worried about with depleted excess savings, you know, not shoring up the economy by spending, that we may already be in the midst of it, and it doesn't appear to be adversely impacting bank earnings. And if it's not adversely impacting the big financials, I wouldn't expect it to trickle through and adversely impact other segments of the economy. One of the stocks, the three stocks that I wanted to look at as like the temperature check are Walmart, Amazon, and UPS. Walmart, biggest retailer in the country. They're also going to be contending with wage increases throughout the country as a lot of those go into effect this year, a lot of higher minimum wages, my state included. I think something like 28 states raised their minimum wage to start this year. Amazon obviously is another big retailer. It's a big measure of consumer spend, but it's also a good measure of spending by businesses continuing to develop, you know, AI tools, so we can sort of get a temperature check there for AI. And then also for advertising spending, you know, obviously Google is big there, but if we see companies that are increasing their web spend, you would expect probably a commensurate ad spend increase as well. And then another one that I wanted to flag was UPS, and I've got some more specific details on them. But with UPS, you know, they are something of a bellwether for shipping, which, I mean, we're a service economy, and what we do spend on retail is increasingly getting shipped to us. They had their own challenge with labor costs. Obviously, they had strikes last year that diverted some volumes away from them that they're going to be looking to get back. But I'll be watching them for sentiment on the broader economy, especially because FedEx showed weaker holiday volumes than expected. So I think those three are going to be three to pay attention to for commentary more than anything. One of the numbers on Amazon, their web services growth in the most recent reported quarter was 12%. That's really critical for the company, and it, you know, it influences this FANG Magnificent Seven narrative as well, right? Because they're included there. For their web services segment, they made $7 billion on $23 billion of revenues, or $7 billion of income on $23 billion of revenues. And that's really where they're deploying their generative AI capabilities. You've got partnerships with companies like BMW, Adidas, Bookings.com is on there. And if companies are going to be spending on the AI narrative, on the generative AI, Amazon's going to be a direct beneficiary. So by watching their earnings, we can see, one, our consumers continuing to spend, two, our businesses continuing to spend on AI, which was our big narrative last year. And it is sort of a rubber meets the road moment for that tech.
Okay. And that leads into number three. You were going to talk about Amazon and the money switch. So they're about to flip.
Yeah, so starting on January 29th, they are going to automatically move every Prime subscriber, which is estimated to be 168 million households in the U.S., or I'm sorry, 168 million people in the U.S., not households. They're going to switch every Prime subscriber from a free from an ad-free Prime Video to an ad-supported Prime Video.
Mm-hmm.
That's expected to add $2 to $5 billion in revenues for them in some combination of either ad revenues or a $3 monthly fee to avoid seeing ads. Nobody really expects that they're going to up that anybody's going to up their monthly Prime spend to avoid seeing ads on the shows. But that's $2 to $5 billion in what is essentially free money for them. It will make them the biggest ad supported service in the economy, like ad supported service by viewership. So any of the streamers, cable networks, anything. Amazon's going to become the biggest. Netflix, per Nielsen, has a 7.4% view share among, you know, streaming among all TV watchers. So not just streaming watchers, but among all TV watchers, versus 3.4% for Amazon. Where I'm more interested in it is not that 2 to 5 billion annual bump. Like we said, or like I said earlier, web services alone is 7 billion a quarter. So it's not super, super meaningful. Where I'm very curious to see what happens with them is if they start leveraging that ad display with their other mechanisms, with their retail arm. So let's say, all right, you're now the most popular ad-supported network in the country. Pampers wants to sell diapers via Amazon, right? Okay, well, maybe we can offer more price discounts if you spend more on ad. Or maybe we can do more AI-influenced prioritization of ad display. So by simultaneously being like what is effectively the most prolific retailer in the country and the biggest ad supported network in the country, they have a lot of opportunity to hyper focus where ads are served and who sees them. And that's a really, really big revenue opportunity beyond even just blasting out ads to everybody that may or may not want them, but is unlikely to spend more to avoid them.
I wonder if it'll have much effect on Amazon's share price, at least in the near term, though, you know, given the run up in the last year, and that it's, you know, it's not something the public is, you know, terribly aware of. You know, maybe Wall Street is. Maybe where you'll really see it is if you get some earnings beats from Amazon as a result of this in the coming quarters. You know, it's not one big like new initiative. I guess it is, but it's not, I guess, a headline grabber the way that, you know, Tesla launching a new car or something is, or, you know, or Amazon when they launched their streaming service. So I wonder if it'll be kind of a slow burn in the share price.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect anything. I mean, if anything, Amazon's going to be slow playing this. They don't want everybody up in arms about the fact that they're now going to start seeing ads on this service that they pay for. But they're really sort of a perfect test case for it, because most of the Prime subscribers are not subscribing to watch Prime Video. They're subscribing to get free delivery on like dog food or batteries or, you know, whatever. Like it's an added bonus that you can see Thursday Night Football or that you can see whatever their Prime content is. So if it's only an added bonus, is anybody going to care that there's now ads being displayed on it? I don't think they will. I do agree that it'll trickle through in earnings and, you know, maybe buys them a slightly higher valuation, but I don't think it's going to be a big mover for them. But I think looking out at a longer term picture, it points to more upside for them, especially if they can integrate that well. Although,
yeah, it makes their growth more sustainable. It's sort of a new growth avenue or stream for you know, a company that has lots of them, but not many that are fresh, I guess.
Well, and increasingly, they don't really care. You know, famously, Bezos said, you know, we don't really care about Prime Video, but if it gets somebody to buy an extra pair of shoes, then we love it. But I think that's sort of fallen by the wayside. anybody that uses Amazon as a service knows that if you search for a product, you're going to get all these Amazon marketplace offerings for knockoff cheaply made stuff first, right? Like these paid placements, and then you'll get the product that you actually look for. And they're essentially so fully integrated into the sort of consumer lifestyle that it doesn't really matter what they do from a shopping standpoint. It's where they can generate extra value from within that search to buy sort of process.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to our next segment, which is called Jump Ball. I believe this is the third time we've done it. And for this segment, we will welcome on our producer, Madison Robertson, to help us out. Madison, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Oh, muted. Come on, you're the production person. You got to know this.
That's so embarrassing.
It's all right.
Well, thanks for having me. It's early. I'm a mom now. I can do this.
That's right. Yeah.
Have you been? Mom Brain is real.
Yeah. Of course you're on. You're on right after your first episode back. That's right. The hot sauce special. Yeah. How is everything going there?
Awesome. It's so fun. She's so great. It's so cute. I honestly didn't think I was going to be a mom ever, and now I'm like, how did I ever think that? She's just the cutest. She likes me so much. Babies don't usually like me, and she really likes me. So that helps.
That's good to hear.
Also, thanks. Also, on Brad's Vegas note, like, Chris, does Brad strike you as the person that would end up on the top of the roof on a Vegas trip? Because he kind of does.
Not really. But yeah. I could see Vegas bringing out some sort of darkness in him. I don't know what exactly that is. You know, maybe in like a Leaving Las Vegas kind of way. I don't really know.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty spot on. But you guys missed the easy comp, which is the Zach Galifianakis, just from an appearance standpoint. It was maybe more visible a few years ago when I was a little bit heavier, but that's the easy comp.
Yeah.
So you're taking Galifianakis. You're taking your satchel then. He's telling us he's taking his satchel to Vegas.
Yeah.
I wish I had the ability to spin out 80 grand from blackjack winnings that he had.
Yeah, the card counting, that part I could see, like the Rain Man that I could definitely see. Okay, so yes, Jump Ball, just to explain, is as Madison's going to read off, we pit a bunch of things against each other, and we say, what do we think will do perform better? We're doing this for, I've made this for basically, what do we think will perform better in 2024, since we're at the beginning of the year? Brad and I will both choose. We have not coordinated before. We don't know who's choosing what. We may be aligned a lot. We may not. So let's kick it off.
All right. First one, large caps versus small caps in 2024.
I'll go first. I think small caps, as we've mentioned, when we had Tyler London on, they've underperformed for at least two, three years now. And as Tyler has mentioned, small caps tend to outperform large caps. They're just by nature, they're companies at the beginning of their growth, trajectory. And as are their stocks, and we haven't seen that the last couple of years. So I think they play catch up in a big way. You know, they not only do they outperform over time, but they, according to Tyler, tend to outperform 3 out of every 5 years. With 2 years of underperformance, seems like we're due for a bounce back. And while I think large caps will perform well, I think small caps will outperform this year. What say you?
Yeah, I'm gonna agree with you on this. The tough variable, right, is obviously the Magnificent Seven. But the thing that decided it for me, Bruce had written recently about the performance of growth stocks versus value stocks. But if you look back over like the last 3 years, I believe the growth stocks, including the high flyers, like the Mag Seven, have only returned like 8.9% annually over the last 3 years. So despite this outperformance by the mega cap tech names, it's coming off a period of really underperformance, and the valuation is sky high. I think there's a lot more opportunity in the smaller cap names to generate closer to double digit returns. So I think I'm going to have to go. I'm going to have to be on the same page as you on this one, Chris.
Okay. So we're aligned. That's not much fun. All right, let's go to the next one.
Chinese stocks versus Japanese stocks.
So the context for this a little bit is that the Nikkei just reached the highest level in 34 years.
That's Japanese stocks.
Yes, the Japanese stock index. Chinese stocks have been underperforming for the last several years, right? The sort of post-COVID economy roaring back to life never really arrived the way people expected. You've got housing, and you've got property issues. You've got the shadow banking system that supports a lot of these developers, but that's not really captured in any official numbers, hanging overhead. I'll take Japanese stocks on this one. It's not even a close competition. I still see more troubles in China than I do elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit torn, as our former colleague Tim Lutz used to always say, trends last longer than anyone expects. And in that regard, Japanese stocks, have off a good year. You'd think they'd continue that way, and they probably will. I've been so bullish on Chinese stocks as a contrarian play and as a bounce back, just because they're so beaten down last year that I'm normally the growth and momentum guy, but I'll go value in this case. I know China's issues are deeper than just underperformance, but I think I would go, Japanese stocks at 34 year high. It's a reason. There's a reason that they struggled for 3+ decades. So I'll go with the stock market that has shown, it has proven that they can go up in a hurry. And that's Chinese stocks. So I'll go Chinese stocks for this year. So we're on different ends there. Okay, what's next?
Bitcoin versus oil.
Bitcoin, easy for me. I made this call. This is one of the calls I made last year that was actually right. I said Bitcoin would hit, what was it, 40,000 before oil hit $100 a barrel. It was close, but I was right. And I doubled down on that. I've since doubled down on that and said Bitcoin will hit new highs, which would be above 65,000, which is a ways to go from here before oil hits 100. So I'm sticking to that. It's a bull market, and I think Bitcoin's only utility is in bull markets. And I think it'll continue to be a bull market for most of the year, if not all. And therefore, I think, Bitcoin has, oil can only run up so much. It's at 70, well, just over $70 a barrel right now. So $73 a barrel. So, even if it got to $100 a barrel, that's less than 50% growth. Whereas Bitcoin can run up in a hurry. I mean, it's at 43,000 now, 65,000, that would be, roughly 50%. And that's where I think it's going. So Bitcoin.
Yeah, I'm going to do the unfun thing, and I'm going to agree with you as well. From an economic perspective, if oil prices rise too high, there are economic knock-on effects of that. And there are, you can implement price controls. There's a real economy effect that overheated oil prices can have. Bitcoin is not limited to in that same way. It's entirely a bull market play at this point. Maybe it becomes something more in the future. I still think the tech is interesting and novel, and I can see value for it. But for the time being, there's no upside cap on Bitcoin. It can be worth whatever people want it to be worth. But if you had oil at $200 a barrel, for instance, it's going to cause real pain in the real economy. So for that reason, I'm in the same boat as you, Chris.
Okay. I'm trying to gauge which topic we can actually put Madison to sleep on live on air with. That was close, but we're not quite there. Okay. What's next?
Federal funds rate higher or lower than 4.5% by year's end.
Okay. So we were just talking about this. You said, who was it that said it's going to go down to 3.75%?
All right. So I'll take a slight step back on this. I was hoping to save the JP Morgan thing as a gotcha for you to spring on you, but it didn't seem like it would be the journalistic thing to do. Yeah, JP Morgan came out and said they expect 6 rate cuts with a Fed funds target at 4%. They didn't indicate in their notes whether that's in the 4 to 4.25 range or it's in the 3.75 to 4, but 6 rate cuts of a quarter point each would put them in the 3.75 to 4. Yeah. My, you know,
4.5%, just to be clear. So right now we're 5.25 to 5.5%. Right. So basically 4.5% would be more than 3 rate cuts.
It would be three or four. Either one of those, right, the range, right, touches 4.5. But yeah, if you're looking at the lower bound of the range, that would be 3 rate cuts. My gut says 3 rate cuts is right, but I should have learned longer ago, but I have learned not to second guess Jamie Dimon and the JP Morgan team. Yeah. I'm going to go it's below 4.5%.
Okay. I'm going to go right at 4.5%. I'm going to say there will be three rate cuts, but no more. And I still am skeptical that there will be one in March. You know, now 3/4 of economists are calling for it or expect that to fully happen now. Although it was barely more than half a week ago, I think we're still good. I could see them, the Fed, coming out end of this month, when they certainly won't cut rates at the end of this month, I don't think. I could see their language throwing a bit of cold water on it, especially after we just had an inflation number that came in slightly higher than expected. I think the first cut will come in May. Now after that, I could see 2 more happening this year, but I don't know. Obviously, I'm going against the grain at this point, but I'm skeptical that the Fed will start cuts that early, or as early as people expect.
I think I'll go with March. So if we need to punish ourselves for anything, we've got the head-to-head. You're saying,
yeah, this will all be March. Documented for our mid-year punishment episode. Okay. All right, what's next, Madison?
Right. Inflation higher or lower than 2.5%?
Is this at year end?
Yeah, by year end. Yep.
I'm gonna go slightly higher. I think it'll moderate a lot, and it'll get back to something that we spent a lot of last year talking about, which is the, hey, isn't 2.5% inflation good enough?
Right.
Right.
According to what people think, yes, or even more than that is good enough. More than 3 is good enough.
Yeah.
I think it'll be above. If I'm saying only 3 rate cuts, then I definitely think it'll be above 2.5%. Inflation, because anything below that, I definitely think we'll go more than 3 rate cuts. So I think we're aligned there. Sorry, I cut you off. What else were you going to say?
No, just that one thing that we're sort of learning with this rate hike and rate cut cycle is that just the U.S. economy, you know, all the comparisons to prior hike cycles like this go back to the 70s and 80s, right, when we had super high inflation. The economy is a very, very different beast than it was back then. Predominantly a service economy, most small businesses are websites, right? It's not like you're trying to spin up a small manufacturing plant, right? And you've got to go out and you've got to incur all these interest expenses from borrowing. The economy now is not nearly as borrowing driven, I think, for small businesses as it had been 50 years ago or 40 years ago. So I think that goes to both the sort of rate cut thing and to the inflation thing. If inflation's a little bit higher, we don't have to be as aggressive tamping it down, because rates can just sort of stay slightly higher, and it's not going to be the kind of crisis it might have been 50 years ago. So I think the Fed can afford to be less aggressive, and correspondingly, inflation will stick around a little bit more. But I do think the Fed will exceed your 3 rate cuts still, even in spite of all that.
Okay. All right. What's next?
Magnificent Seven stocks versus bull market stocks.
So, Chris, before you get into this one, you run a portfolio stock of the week, which is pretty diverse. You know, it's actually, I don't know if it's the largest just by equity count, but it's a fairly large portfolio. Do you have any of the?
Yeah, I'm up to 26 stocks now. Yep.
Have you had any of the Mag 7 stocks? Were you in those last year?
So yeah, I had 2. I've had 2 pretty much all of last year. I won't say which. if you want to find out, subscribe. I did have two, and my stock of the week portfolio played out last year almost exactly how the market played out, which is what you expect. Those two Magnificent Seven stocks were two, maybe not my two exact top performers, but they're two of my top performers for most of the year. Then that flipped the last 2 months of the year. And now, let's see, I have 26 stocks in there. All but one is up. And about, let's see, more than 20 of them are up double digits since I added them. And I added all but one of them, all but one or two of them last year. So you're seeing it, just anecdotally, you're seeing it across all stocks now, to the point where, you know, every stock I've picked since the beginning of November is up and has actually outperformed the market. So, and, you know, this isn't bragging for me because my portfolio, stock of the week portfolio, is I select the best Cabot stock from among our other analyst portfolios that I see once per week. I add one per week to my portfolio, and 26 is high. I mean, this is the highest I've ever been, and that's just reflective of a really good market lately. I'm not finding much I want to sell, and you know, the export portfolio keeps expanding. So if you want to sign up for that premium advisories page on CabotWealth.com. But anyway, I digress. Back to Mag 7 versus bull market stocks.
And bull market stocks, I'll add a little bit of color on as well. That's a Mike Santolo term, Cabot Growth Investor, top 10 trader, yep. Chief analyst there, chief investment strategist at Cabot. So these are the stocks that perform well in bull markets. Typically, they are, capital markets stocks. They're your big M&A, the companies that make money during M&A, that make money during IPOs, the investment banks, firms like that. I am, if the qualification is Mag 7 stocks for the rest of the year versus bull market stocks, bull market stocks, this is all sort of playing into that same, like, hey, the bull market is back, baby narrative. If we get 6 rate cuts, JP Morgan had a 13% bump in their deal making activity and revenues from capital markets in the last quarter. And that was in a market where everybody was a little bit more bearish and things looked maybe a little bit overcooked. And let's say that the Mag 7 are overcooked. And I mean, I say that they've run up, what, NVIDIA's up 30% in the last few months, something like that.
Yeah. Collectively, the Magnificent 7 were up 111% last year on average.
So, I mean, even if those go up another 10% from, like, that's phenomenal performance. That's unlikely to be replicated. But I do think that the bull market is sort of fully in play. We're seeing it in deal making. Give me the bull market stocks. They don't have the overvalued narrative hanging over their head, even though you look at some of these companies like your Goldman's or your KKR's, they're trading near all-time highs as well, just like the Mag 7, but they don't have that same narrative overhang. So give me the bull market stocks for the rest of the year over the Mag 7.
Yep, no, I agree. I guess the one caveat is that you're playing devil's advocate. The Mag 7 stocks are all tech stocks, and tech stocks in bull markets, usually, especially the biggest ones, usually fare quite well, but they're usually not coming off a year like they just had. I could see Mag 7 outperforming, maybe like the first half of the year, just based on momentum. And but I think for the whole year, I do think the Mag 7 stocks will hit a rough patch at some point. Even we saw in the last 2 months of the year, while those 7 stocks didn't crater, we saw it was really the rest of the stocks, the unloved stocks, the unloved 493, that sort of carried the market the last 2 months of the year versus those. And those sort of underperformed. And I think that's what we're going to see this year.
All right. Max, okay. What's next?
BYD versus Rivian or some other non-Tesla US EV.
Yeah, so this is a Chris special here. So BYD, as I mentioned, is one of the stocks in my stock of the week portfolio. I've been high on it. It's China's version of Tesla. there, while the company has been killing it, they surpassed Tesla sales in the most recent quarter for the first time ever. The stock continues to lag. It had a good first half of last year, but then it really just turned into a wall. And that's because of what we discussed. It's getting dragged down by perception of China, especially among US investors or Western investors. I think as I've been high on it. Maybe I'm being stubborn, but I think as perceptions of negative perceptions of China ease a bit, and its recovery, maybe not expands, but at least continues, I think the stock price will catch up with the performance in the company. And I put in Rivian. It's just, a prime U.S. example of an upstart, a non-Tesla upstart that's getting traction. I think Tyler mentioned that on here as one of his favorite stocks when he was on here a few weeks ago. But you could substitute any electric vehicle stock in there, U.S. electric vehicle stock in there. I still like BYD, but I could be talked out of it. Brad, what do you think?
Yeah, despite what I said about liking Japanese stocks more than Chinese stocks, I will carve out something of an exception for a company like BYD, mm-hmm. because they do what China does really well, which is take sort of previous generation tech and mass produce the heck out of it. So delivering low-cost electric vehicles using not quite cutting-edge lithium-ion batteries is sort of their bread and butter, or it's yeah. in that zone, especially when we start talking about expanding internationally. China has potentially India as a customer base, the global south, but that seems unlikely just because of infrastructure issues. But they could easily expand into Europe or even potentially the US if we got into sort of less frosty trade relations. Obviously you could get something like a war over Taiwan that would put the kibosh on all this, and that would just lock down any kind of global exports from China of EVs or any kind of tech at all. But absent something like that, I think it's really in the sweet spot for Chinese manufacturing. So I would go with BYD as well. And, part of that is something we talked about with Tyler, which is I don't see Rivians on the road. I mean, obviously I don't see BYD cars on the road either because they don't come into the US. But
see, I do see Rivians on the road a lot here. It used to be maybe 2 years ago, there was like one guy I knew, like, oh, they ordered a Rivian. And I'd see a Rivian. Whenever I'd see a Rivian around, it was him driving. Now I see them. I'd say I see a Rivian every day on the road. Maybe it's different. I mean, a little more environmentally conscious here than maybe in Arizona. So maybe that's why you don't see them. But
we've got a whole dealership down the road. Obviously. Yeah.
Now, did either of you see the headline that Hertz is selling something like 20,000 cars from their EV fleet?
Mm-mm.
So they're selling 20,000 cars out of their EV fleet because they were more expensive to maintain, not from a ongoing sort of normal maintenance standpoint, but from collisions, because a lot of these electric cars use like a monobody design, which makes it really, really hard to just replace a component in the event of a minor traffic accident, right? You can't just fix a weld or replace a fender or something like that. You've got this mono frame that you have to replace entire chunks of. So they're kind of a nightmare from a collision standpoint. We are also starting to hit the time frame where a lot of these cars are getting to the end of their sort of natural battery life. Lithium ions tend to start running out around year 7 with performance drawdowns around like year 3, 4, 5. And that's part of the reason why there's been very little demand for these secondhand EVs, because you essentially have to go in and then spend 20 grand to replace the battery pack. So I think if we see some of the real world impacts of EV ownership start to trickle out into the media, into people's daily lives, there's going to be less demand for your Rivians.
And I'm looking at Rivian's chart. I thought BYD's performance or stock performance lagged the company performance. Rivian came public in November 2021. That's a tough time to come public.
Top tick, right? Right at the top of the market.
100, right around 130. It is now at $17.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even in the last year, it is up only 4.5%. So the stock's been pretty stubborn. Maybe it's just not, the company's not mature enough yet to really get going, whereas BYD's is. So yeah, give me BYD. Okay, what's next?
Is this Ravens and Niners, or Ravens or Niners?
Ravens. Okay, yeah, sorry. Yeah, these are one non-investment related. Ravens, yeah. Who do we have? Ravens, Niners, or the field in the NFL playoffs? Mm-hmm. I think so, right?
Those are words I understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is for eventual Super Bowl champion, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I hate to do it. It's so boring. Give me the Ravens, Niners. The Ravens look like the best team in football right now. I don't see anybody in the AFC unseating them. The Chiefs have looked bad all year. Miami is good, but they're
playing in -7 degrees. Did you know that? That in Kansas, the game in Kansas City this weekend is -7 degrees at game time, minus like 20 something wind chill for Miami.
But Taylor Swift's not going to that one.
No, you're right. She might have. I mean, they'd have to update the heating system, I think, in the players' girlfriend/wife's box there for her to go. But I mean,
if my wife was playing in that game, I would not go. Well, if she was, if
we're playing in that game,
if Mahomes got hurt and my wife had to step in as starting quarterback for the Chiefs, I'd wish her luck and not go.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Unbearable.
Yeah, I'm going to take the field. While Ravens Niners are pretty clearly the best two teams, I don't know, they're so dominant that I'm willing to take those two against the other 10. Plus, I have a rooting interest. My team would be one of the candidates to unseat those teams. I'm a Bills fan, as we've discussed here before. Not that I trust them whatsoever. I could see them losing this weekend against the Steelers or winning the whole thing. I don't know.
Let's put a number to it. So over under 1.5 wins for the Bills.
Okay, so if they beat the Steelers, which they really should. I mean, Steelers, who's the Rudolph is their quarterback? I don't even know his first name.
They started Mitch Trubisky this year. They shouldn't even be in the conversation.
I know, it's all coaching. They're like the anti-Bills, where they maximize their talent constantly just through good coaching and good sort of, you know, a good foundation. The Bills have immense talent and they struggle to match it a lot of times. I do think they'll win this week, so that's one. Then they would host probably the Chiefs. I don't see the Dolphins making out of minus 20 wind chills. I mean, that's been their nemesis. But you're right. The Chiefs have not been very impressive this year. Maybe they'll flip a switch in the playoffs. I'll go over. Over 1.5.
Over.
Bills. Give me the Bills to win the Super Bowl. Yeah, let's go nuts.
Well, they just legalized sports betting in your neck of the woods, I understand. So are you gonna put money on it for once your life?
Oh, absolutely not. I don't bet on my own team. No, I'm not Pete Rose here. Okay. So let's see. Anything else? Any other over-unders we want to do, like with your Vegas trip, anything like that? How much money? Let's set the over-under how much money you will win or lose. Are you in the red or in the black by the end of the weekend?
I will probably lose $300 playing like craps and let it ride, and that'll probably be it.
That's specific.
Well, $300. Wow. Okay. So, we'll put a fund up here. I'll have Matt put a fund up here where people can donate a GoFundMe page. Or maybe we'll just try and get advertisers if you do lose money.
Although last time I was in Vegas, I did come home with a little bit of a stack. So that was a win, but no, I'm going to...
You're going to do it for a loss.
At the end of the day, I'm going to be down $300, $400, $500, but probably $300 in case my wife listens.
Okay. We'll expect the answer on here next week. We'll need your tax return too. Okay. Well, Madison, thank you for indulging us in this silly exercise and helping us out. as always, like, subscribe, 5-star rating, all that good stuff, and or donate to Brad's Vegas gambling fund. We will see you again next week on Street Check, and have a good long weekend, everyone.